Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's The Wonky Show. Ref 2029 has been reshaped. We'll have a look at what's been agreed. There's a crackdown on franchising. We'll get across that. How was 2025 for you? It's all coming up.
You know, that direction of travel, I think, has kind of made people slightly blind to the things that you've seen on social media and the things that we've all seen with our own eyes, whether it's, you talk about that Sunday Times investigation. I mean, if you've walked through Oxford, that particular college was above a restaurant, a closed restaurant called Cafe Opium. You know, and so I think it's that sort of 2016, 2017 moment that sort of stopped us seeing what we could all see.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to look at what's under the HE policy tree, as usual, three top draw guests. In London, Steph Harris is Director of Policy at Universities UK. Steph, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, well, I don't think it's happened yet. It's the UK Christmas party today, so hopefully that will turn into my highlight of the week.
In Manchester, Andy Westwood is Professor of Public Policy, Government and Business at the University of Manchester. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I started this week at the Guinness Brewery in Dublin, and it's been hard to shake that off in lots of ways, but it was a tremendous highlight.
And in London, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's my son's nativity this afternoon, so I'll be rushing back home to attend that. And he's a camel, so yeah, big responsibility.
So yes, we start this week with the ref. UKRI has published a glut of stuff. Michael, what's the deal here?
Yes, so we've had this 3-month pause, which was always quite badly named, but essentially there's been 3 months where there's been complete uncertainty about what the future of the exercise will look like. This followed Science Minister Patrick Vallance sort of announcing this pause back in September, and rumblings had been building for quite a while that the government and other important stakeholders weren't very happy with what it was looking like. And it's been triumphantly unpaused. It was announced at the UK Research and Innovation Conference. A ton of different stuff has all been published up on the REF team site, and it's not fully come into focus exactly what the 2029 exercise is going to be like yet, exactly, despite the fact it's 2026 very, very soon. But what we have in broad strokes is something that doesn't look a million miles away from how it was in 2021. Some of the ambition to have a very different sort of endeavor from the last one has been kind of, let's say, toned down a bit. Perhaps the most eye-catching, but also the most expected thing is that the element of the REF assessment that's about environment has been toned down a little bit. It's going to be worth 20% instead of 25%. The word culture has been taken out of the title very dramatically, and it's now going to be called strategy, people, and research environment. This also therefore means that more of the REF overall assessment is based on outputs. That side of things has been revised upwards. There's been quite a lot of other changes too around things like portability, maximum submissions per researcher, the sort of balance between institution and unit level stuff. Not sure how much any of this is, podcast gold. I think the key thing to understand from all of it is there's been quite a lot of compromise in lots of different areas where the REF team and the research councils have been coming in for quite a lot of sustained criticism for several years, but it largely is compromise rather than a complete about turn.
Well, fascinating. Trigger warning if you've not heard him speak since the dark days of COVID. Here's a little clip from Science Minister Patrick Vallance.
It will, as Jessica said, recognise excellence in research outputs, and I'm very pleased that that percentage for that has gone up. That is a fundamental thing that REF needs to do. Make sure that we really assess, are the outputs world-class, and if not, where are they world-class and where are they not so? Second thing, and this is equally important, you know, and I know, none of this works without thriving environments. Environments in which people can succeed. Environments in which everyone can succeed. And what you do, what your academics do in your institutions is difficult. I mean, if this was easy, everyone would be good at it. It's difficult. And when you have difficult problems, you don't solve difficult problems by having a monolithic culture. You don't solve difficult problems by everybody coming from the same background, everybody having the same experience. So diversity and inclusion is not some nice to have. It's fundamental to how we get better outcomes. It's fundamental to how the system works. It's fundamental to how we end up with better ability from all the diversity of the population we have in the UK. So that's not a sort of nice to have. It is an essential. It's a prerequisite for what we're talking about.
Now, fascinating. Now, Michael, before we get into the weeds of all this diversity and inclusion stuff, I noticed that the Office for Students has sort of intervened in research. You know, sadly, not over PGRs, which it has conspicuously never done. It's over this issue, isn't it?
Yeah, so there was just at this 11 a.m. moment where a ton of different documents got published. One of the things was a blog post from Office for Students Free Speech Director Arif Ahmed, where he was sort of setting out his, I think, you know, very laudable sort of position, which is that, you know, research quality depends very highly on academic freedom. But interestingly, also, he kind of published publicly something the OFS had submitted to the funding councils and the REF team about, you know, the problems they saw with the people, culture and environment element, as was, especially around things like sort of universities being possibly required to, or at least encouraged to, sign up to charters, which obviously Arif Ahmed has you know, taken issue with quite extensively in the past. He's also making some recommendations about, you know, academic freedom being seen as part of, you know, what makes a good research environment, which from what I could see, although, you know, this part of the element of the design of the REF is still a bit in the air, but it doesn't really seem like it's had a big impact that we can see yet. I mean, it is interesting, like you say, you know, to see the OFS sort of intervening in the research space is very unusual. To have a system where both the OFS and Research England are sort of telling universities things about how, you know, their staff environment and their staff policies is potentially a bit awkward, especially because the REF is UK-wide and, you know, the other funding councils in other parts of the UK are telling universities different things. So, yeah, a little complicated.
So, right, fascinating. The culture wars go on. Maybe Patrick and Ari should get in a room. Now, Andy, so culture becomes strategy, but institutions define what strategy is. Is this a kind of rhetorical concession, or is it meaningful?
Well, it's a tweak, isn't it? Like lots of the changes we heard yesterday. You know, these aren't major changes to an exercise, and I suspect those places, those institutions and departments that have been, well, doing anything but pause over the last 3 months will look at that as a tweak. I think they'll see strategy. I mean, you know, what are institutional strategies about the REF? Let's do as well as we can in it. So that should save lots of institutions and departments a bit of time. But I think we need to sort of think a little bit more about how this exercise now joins up with the speech that you were probably talking about 2 or 3 weeks ago that Patrick Vallance, along with Ian Chapman, gave at the Science Museum on the UKRI strategy, and beyond that, the additional money that government is spending on R&D. And by 2029, we'll have had 3 years of their three buckets approach. And it seems very dangerous to me for institutions to think about the REF as a sort of tweaked version of the last one, when actually the kind of context in R&D policy that surrounds it, and remember, the REF, the QR that kind of allocates the money beyond the REF is now less than 10% of the money that kind of government is spending on R&D. Less than 10%. When I first started working in R&D policy, it was nearly half. So, you know, the big challenge here is not to get sucked straight down into the weeds and to think about how does the kind of setting out of how the REF's going to work with all of those tweaks, including around strategy, including around kind of, you know, what can be submitted, what can't be submitted. How is that going to join up with the much bigger, spending much larger amounts of money strategies that governments kind of set out in the last few weeks? And that, I think, is how we should think about yesterday's REF announcements. On Arif Ahmed, I would imagine Patrick Vallance saw that as about as welcome as finding out there was going to be a second wave of COVID. But so I wouldn't suggest they get in a room because I don't know what will happen. But, you know, this is all 2029. Like I say, 3 years' time, I'd be very surprised if Arif Ahmed is around at that point.
But this is the point, right? This is the question. So if the white paper said the REF was going to sort of reward alignment with government priorities, like, that has disappeared. What is going on? It's Research England kind of defending autonomy or storing up a problem for itself.
Well, that's why I think it matters that it's 3 years away. And I think, you know, in that time, we can expect to see institutions, firms, policymakers get kind of more and more familiar with and more used to those three buckets. And for the REF to be utterly immune from that, I think would be A, wrong, and B, very unlikely. My concern is that lots of people looking at the REF announcements will think that's exactly what it's going to be. You know, an exercise that sits apart from all these things that government wants to achieve with the way it spends its R&D money and the way it kind of pushes its economic strategy and its industrial strategy.
Yeah. But Steph, presumably there's a danger here that, you know, this little corner of what now amounts to this little corner of R&D spend is, you know, off doing its autonomous things and, you know, sidelining itself.
Yeah, I think, well, look, I agree with what Andy has said to the large part. And I'm not sure that I think that yesterday's announcement means that the REF is just going to be a little corner sat over there doing its own stuff whilst the rest of the R&D budget worries about delivering government's priorities. I personally think it's quite interesting that they've added strategy in there. If you look at what the Post-16 Skills White Paper says and some of the kind of what I'll describe on this podcast but nowhere else as bucket theory says, you can see that there is a sense that the government wants institutional university research strategies to be highly aligned with where government priorities are. And if they're going to have a hope of accessing perhaps not the rest of the 90%, but probably, you know, the rest of the 50% of the R&D funding that's out there in the system, then they're going to have to do that anyway. So, you know, I think it would be overstating it to say that the kind of focus on institutional strategy is pointing towards some of that government priorities by stealth. But I do think it's a nod to it. I don't think it's completely true that it's REF's going to sit over there divorced from everything else.
Michael, where are we on this? You know, who produces research? Is it individuals or teams? Like, where are we on that?
We're sort of, I think where we've ended up is somewhere in the middle ground, which was, to be fair, is exactly where we were in REF 2021 as well. I think it's very clear that there's, you know, but in the sort of space of the research policy people involved, you know, at Research England and elsewhere in the UK who are sort of driving the REF, they are very keen that it is, you know, an assessment of environments and institutions. After all, it's, you know, it's institutions who are funded via the, you know, QR and other things that come out of REF scores, and they would like it to be as much of an assessment of institutions and much less about people. But where we are is a halfway house. You know, as I've said before, portability is coming back in the odd area, like especially in units that are based frequently around long form outputs. You know, lots of individual researchers had said, you know, we admire this ambition for, you know, REF to be about institutions, but, you know, we have jobs, we have bills to pay, you know, we need security. It is entirely bound up with individuals in that, you know, if you are a researcher, so much of your career progression depends on things related to the REF, you know, for certain kinds of researchers. So yeah, and same with the sort of move away from minimum and maximum number of outputs per researchers. So they have continued to keep at the minimum, So there's no minimum, you know, there's not everybody who's doing on a research contract needs to be returned to the ref in 2029, but they have sort of put the maximum back in after various criticisms, you know, but there's an exemption. Universities will have to explain it if they do submit more outputs per researcher. I think that this is a real example of where you can see, you know, plenty of compromise aimed at smoothing over, you know, internal, you know, within the UK higher education system, disputes that had arisen around some of the, you know, quite substantial changes that were being proposed.
Yeah. But I mean, and you know, on that and this kind of raft of other issues, we've sort of ended up with a kind of fudgy compromise, haven't we? Is this Research England trying to be too radical to start with and not bringing everyone with it? Or is it the kind of classic shock and awe, then water it down so you can get on with it?
Yeah, I think there's an element. I mean, again, you know, was it that radical? Probably not. Did people overreact? Probably. But it has kind of been reined back. There is a bit of a fudge about it. It will keep everybody a little bit happier as they sort of deploy their complicated, labyrinthine internal processes to get us to 2029. So, you know, in that sense, I think kind of peace will break out. However, you know, this is 2029. Other things are going to be happening in 2029. And I think we'd do well as a community to sort of think about the year that this is going to land and to put so much effort. And we know, you know, there are conservative estimates at how much preparation for REF will cost the sector at a time when money is scarce. But I think the bigger cost will be it diverts our attention inwards to a set of processes within institutions and within the sector when, you know, there are elections across the world, including in the UK. And if you really want to read something, if you get bored reading the detail on the ref, read the blog that Richard Jones put out on his Soft Machines Substack. And he basically says that by 2029, the scientific consensus may be breaking down across the West. So, you know, if you really want to see the other picture about kind of what 2029 might mean, have a little read of that. It will take you a lot less time than wading through all this ref documentation.
Okay, so Steph, I mean, you know, part of the reason there was a pause was, you know, other things were going on. People were sort of busy with stuff and some of those other things are going to continue to happen. So either from the kind of apocalyptic point of view or the, you know, the sort of this, you know, this costs a lot of money, both nationally and inside institutions. Surely we should just scrap this.
Look, when it comes to pausing REF 2029 for 3 months, our view was that, yeah, absolutely, you should take the time to get it right. Right, it's too important, both in terms of what it's signifying, the money that it's distributing, and also the time that it takes. And I'll use the word burden, you know, some of the burden that it adds on to institutions. So you should make sure that you're doing the right thing and you're reducing that burden where possible. I think you've all variously described where we've ended up in different language. The language that we used yesterday and I'll use today is pragmatic. Like, I do think it's pragmatic, and you might think that that's a messy compromise. I think it's pragmatism. When it comes to the future of the REF, I would agree with Andy that the world will look very different in 2029. And I imagine before we get to 2029, we'll be having a conversation about what's next for the REF. And that's obviously the right thing to do. I don't have a firm view right now as to what REF, you know, 2036 will look like, or indeed whether there will be a REF 2036, or whether we will have moved to some other way of distributing this funding and assessing research excellence. But for now, we should concentrate with getting on with REF 2029 and keeping that eye on that bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just two other things I'd add. I mean, and this is moving back into the details rather than this sort of, you know, the big geopolitics questions. But I mean, one thing was, I thought it was very interesting on the live stream when Jessica Corner and Patrick Vallance were speaking, there was a lot of us watching it online. And the top comment, you know, people could sort of upvote in the Q&A bit. The top comment said, do you envisage a time when we move from changing REF rules and guidance mid-cycle to a system where, you know, they announce them all in advance and then do it? Which, you know, I think this has been a really big and probably underestimated issue, that things have just taken too long and the clarity's not been there. It means that Research England and others haven't been able to bring with them some of the stakeholders who probably would have supported, you know, changes. You know, this is one thing. I mean, as opposed to seeing it through a lens of, you know, it's been an argument about culture and an argument about EDI, which I think is over-exaggerated. The other thing, if you go back to the government's response to the Sickle review of research bureaucracy, you know, they very clearly said, this was in early 2024, you know, the cost of the REF is too high. Government is committed to bringing the cost of the REF down. We expect it to be significantly, measurably less bureaucratic than REF 2021. I mean, this was under the Conservatives, but I think this very much represents the Whitehall view of things. And, you know, if this was being addressed, you know, this issue of bureaucracy and cost, if it was being addressed by, you know, the REF team, it was not at all clear how. It was never really sort of taken up as a point that work needs to be done. We need to be clear about how we're making it less bureaucratic. It was all just sort of, you know, piling up more and more. And, you know, I think both those two reasons help explain why changes have been made, much more than the sort of supposed backlash over EDI elements.
Well, great stuff. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Richard Freeman, and this week on Wonky, we've been blogging about levelling the playing field for PhD study. The numbers tell a troubling story. While 59% of undergraduates identify as white, that rises to 74% at doctoral level. And just 1.2% of UKRI studentships went to black students over a three-year period, with only 30 to black Caribbean students. Part of the problem? The traditional pathway to understanding PhD study often relies on personal networks and in-person events. But these can be expensive, intimidating, or simply inaccessible for many students, particularly those with disabilities, caring responsibilities, or those who don't come from middle-class backgrounds. That's why we developed Is a PhD Right for Me, a free online course on FutureLearn that potential applicants can access anytime, anywhere. Through frank interviews and diverse representation, we're tackling not just the practical questions about funding and applications, but also the psychological barriers that cause people to talk themselves out of applying. But a MOOC is just one piece of the puzzle. We need systemic change, better supervisor training, transparent monitoring of who's actually making initial inquiries, and support structures throughout the doctoral journey. Because widening participation can't end at enrolment, it has to continue all the way through.
Now, next up, the government response to the admissions consultation on franchising means it's crackdown time, Andy.
Yes, very exciting. Crackdown and crackers time, if we're going to stick with the Christmas theme. Yeah, so lots of stuff here that's been confirmed from the kind of various consultations from both the department and the OFS. All the headlines seem to be, as per that consultation, you know, franchisees over 300 are going to be required to register. The slight downside is that, like many policies across kind of government, it's backloaded. It's something that's going to happen towards the end of the parliament. So, you know, we're talking about 28, 29 before this comes in. Although those organisations that are registering are expected to do so pretty quickly by kind of summer next year. But what's probably more interesting is the sort of narrative that ministers and others have wrapped around this. Bridget Phillipson kind of described it in her sort of official release around this consultation as a kind of, you know, as a problem metastasizing across the sector, talking about terrible value for money for students. So, you know, it's pretty clear that she wants this set of measures to really reduce the numbers and improve the kind of quality across the sort of not just franchise provision, but across the board. And I remember kind of Edward Peck's words at the Festival of Higher Education, and I thought he summed it up even more neatly, where he said, you know, there might be some babies there, but there's an awful lot of bathwater and some of it is very murky. So my guess is that this is a crackdown. This is going to start a long way ahead of that 28, 29. I think the OFS and DfE would take a pretty dim view of those institutions that are doing a lot of this if they continue to do that. But to pick up on Steph's point about pragmatism and the REF, there's probably a little element of them being pragmatic here because, you know, if you're an institution doing a lot of franchising, you're going to fall over if you literally pull the rug now. And 2 to 3 year sort of window allows you to kind of manage that down. And that probably makes a lot of sense as well.
Yes. And this is tricky, isn't it, Steph? Because on the one hand, Andy's clearly right. You know, I mean, you know, if they were thinking of pulling the rug altogether, you know, that would have been very, very dramatic. But of course, the people that get then caught up in the sort of slightly softer version of this are real students with lifetime debts.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I guess both the people that get caught up in the slightly softer version of this, and to be clear, you know, our position and my also personal belief is that there are bits of franchising that are really important, and it can play a really important role in widening participation. And so absolutely, I think there is a sense of not wanting to, well, to quote Edward Peck, throw the baby out with the bathwater in this particular case. I think there is also a sense of government doing what it can do currently with the existing powers that it had. You know, I think the stuff that's in the post-16 skills white paper around giving the OFS additional powers to protect public money probably also signals a bit of a sense of direction here when that there is legislative time to do that. So I agree that this is a kind of a strong signal from government that they're paying attention, that they're taking action in a relatively surgical way for now to try and preserve some of the provision that they believe is important, but I think also probably to give themselves some time to find some additional powers.
Mm. Now, Michael, the Secretary of State sent a letter, didn't she? And one of the things that was sort of interesting in the letter is that she very clearly and specifically highlighted this thing about the weekend.
Yeah, it was interesting. So, yeah, we got the letter, Dear All, just sent out across the sector, you know, doing the sort of usual stuff about, you know, the government wants a world-class sector, you know, sort of saying, please get on board with the, you know, university's UK Guild HE admissions code of practice, which, you know, not all providers are signed up to, but, you know, the majority are, you know, saying this sort of, you know, stuff that in the Telegraph is like, you know, the government's cracking down on universities recruiting. And then in the letter, it's like, you know, we'd encourage you to maybe think about reviewing your processes. And it sort of doesn't really amount to much. But as you said, the probably the most interesting detail there was that she said, you know, I'd like to remind everybody that, you know, students who attend only at the weekend are not eligible for maintenance loans. And she sort of referred to existing SLC guidance. And indeed, this, you know, this thing about, you know, needing to attend a certain number of days, or, you know, the rules are sort of quite hard to pass, but it has sort of always been essentially a case, from what I understand, that, you know, your full time means more than just the weekend. But yeah, as you say, it's interesting that it's on the government's radar, and in a sort of 3-page letter that was felt to merit a paragraph, whether it's that, you know, the government's been looking at it itself, or whether, you know, it's been sort of flagged to it as a concern from elsewhere in the sector or in the media. But yes, and as you made the point on the site, Jim, you know, there are lots of franchise provision, or, you know, there are lots of agents for franchise provision, or sort of influencers, even, you know, sort of just people online basically saying, you know, oh, you can study just at the weekend, you can get this massive maintenance loan, it's basically free money. And that is an issue for you know, for those franchise providers, and even for the universities that are subcontracting to them.
I mean, you know, Andy, some of this is about how the courses are sold, but some of it is actually about the courses. I mean, it's clear that there are right now a whole bunch of notionally full-time in attendance courses that are being staged only at the weekend. Do the rules have to change because, you know, the world has changed and students have changed, or do the franchising universities need to pull the rug?
Well, I mean, like you, I'm pretty hawkish on this. And whilst there are, you know, some examples of long-standing kind of good value practice with quite small, sometimes sort of relatively mid-sized kind of provision. But, you know, we know, and you know, and you've done lots and lots of work on this, that the areas you really want to kind of get to the heart of are those that are rapidly expanding. They're partnering with institutions that, you know, maybe aren't offering as much governance of the relationship as they should be. And at the end of the day, it's poor value for money for the students that end up on it. It's also shockingly poor value for money for the public purse. And I think just as the conversation that we've had about the REF and R&D strategy has gone, the clear thing here that government want to do is to push the money that they're currently spending, and it's increasing, don't forget, on this type of provision. You know, they want to reallocate that to places that they think will deliver more outcomes for the economy as a whole, but perhaps even more importantly for the people that kind of take up those options. So, you know, this does join up very much with the sort of not just the low quality debate, but with, you know, what the government and what we should all want from the higher education system, which is, you know, good quality provision, real outcomes for students, and, you know, and levers that allow us to kind of to guarantee that. And I think going back to the kind of 28, 29 point, it's fairly clear that government may need to kind of legislate in some of these areas in order to have all of the controls that they're going to require if these are the sort of outcomes they want to seek. And so, you know, another explanation, I think, for that pragmatism or that slightly longer term horizon is that to really get this job done, they're probably going to have a little bit more legislation behind them than they currently have or that HERA currently offers them.
Now, Steph, when a lot of this kicked off in February, in the Times, I think it was the Sunday Times, Bridget Phillipson said, we don't believe that domestic agents have got any role to play in the sector and we'll take action to, you know, eradicate them. Now, that's disappeared. And actually, in the meantime, your UK's Fair Admissions Code has been updated to kind of talk about domestic agents. But I've been looking at some of the antics of domestic agents for some of the signatories of that code this week, and it doesn't seem to have changed much in terms of what those agents are up to.
Yeah. Well, look, and I read your article and it was interesting. We did update our code, and I think it's really important that we have. And I think at the bottom of the article, Jim, you said something along the lines of, I mean, you said it much more snappily than this, but something along the lines of the government and probably the sector needs to reflect on whether the actions it's taken so far has had the effect that it needed to have or not. And I think on this issue, that's, you know, where we are. You'd have to talk to the DfE to ask them about where they are on this. But we've updated our code. I think we're taking stock of whether that's enough, both in terms of the kind of language within the code itself, but also how that code is implemented in practice and the kind of behaviour that it's driving in institutions. And I expect that to be a big conversation and part of the UK's work in early 2026. So it's definitely something that has not disappeared from our minds, but you'd have to ask Bridget Phillipson where she is on it.
I'll come back to you in a second, Michael, but Andy, I can't be the only person in Britain doing 10 minutes worth of mystery shopping on TikTok. Is it that institutions don't want to see because they would have to act, or they do see and then don't do anything? I don't get it.
Yeah, well, like you say, I mean, it's not just on TikTok, is it? I mean, you know, we've all been for a walk through various parts of big cities where lots of this kind of provision is clustered. You know, if you want to find this stuff, it's not hard to find. And I think it is and has been a problem for a very long time. I mean, the reason I kind of mentioned legislation is that I think for a long time that the issue has been that, you know, the culture that we saw set up around the act in, you know, Joe Johnson's kind of HERA moment and that white paper was that the private sector was going to come in. It was going to be a sort of an innovative kick to provision. It was going to raise quality. And so the whole kind of culture that surrounded that sort of legislative moment, and of course the Office for Students in that moment was absolutely central to that, was that, you know, this was going to be the sort of provision that would help the higher education sector. So, you know, culturally as well as legislatively, you know, that direction of travel, I think, has kind of made people slightly blind to the things that you've seen on social media and the things that we've all seen with our own eyes, whether it's, you know, you talk about that Sunday Times investigation. I mean, if you've walked through Oxford, that particular college was above a restaurant, a closed restaurant called Cafe Opium. You know, and so I think it's that sort of 2016, 2017 moment that sort of stopped us seeing what we could all see. And I think that's why legislation, alongside the various sort of changes in direction, the various pivots that the government has kind of introduced, not just for the Office for Students, but for the DfE as well, has obviously kind of begun that process of changing that. But, you know, let's not forget how deeply sort of entrenched those behaviours and those kind of ideologies were in the sector. And I think that's why it's grown as rapidly as it has. And of course, you know, institutions haven't had much choice in financial terms but to kind of find ways to boost their bottom line. And unfortunately, for some, you know, this has been a kind of a big direction that they've gone in order to do that.
Yeah. Now, Michael, obviously some of that speaks more broadly to governance. And Jackie Smith's been on the road again, talking about governance again, hasn't she?
Yeah. So this was at the Advance AG Governance Conference on Tuesday. You know, predictably, they got the minister in to talk about governance. And she also then briefed some of the lines, or, you know, the department press office did brief some of the lines. You know, I imagine that the majority of what she said was very sort of positive and constructive and engaging. But as ever, the sort of couple of lines in there that were, you know, giving the sector a bit of a kick were the ones that were given to the papers to run with. You know, she said there's been subpar governance, which has included lack of realistic planning, insufficient recognition of risk and how to manage it. And, you know, the Telegraph had headlined this by saying, you know, it's university's funding crisis is university's fault, is what the government is saying, which, you know, to an extent was true. You know, they were sort of saying, maybe more generously, you know, we've done our part of what we see as the bargain, which is we've put up tuition fees and announced they'll continue to rise, but we're still going to, you know, give you a whack with a stick quite regularly about the aspects of institutional financial instability which are in your own gift. And whether that's sort of governance or management or planning or other aspects of university's behavior, I think we can just expect the government to keep putting the boot in regularly as the sort of, you know, tuition fees quid pro quo.
What's going on here, Steph? Is this classic marketized, you know, governments get to blame someone else, or is, you know, as she got a point in terms of, you know, institutions, you know, we've got that line in there again, haven't we, about institutions being over optimistic with their projections?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think blame is a really helpful word. I think it's an unhelpful word in this case. But I think there is definitely two sides of the story. So it's absolutely true that government has control over a whole bunch of conditions that control the operating environment for universities, right? They have control over a whole bunch of things that affect how you can run your university and what the business model looks like, and how, at least from our membership's point of view, how you can make sure that you break even or make a modest surplus to reinvest in future higher education and research. And then they are also, though, autonomous institutions who have their own governing bodies who have to make sure that they're doing a good job of adapting to those market conditions. One of the things that we heard really strongly in the transformation and efficiency work that we did earlier in the year around governance was how that kind of context and that changing context, and particularly the kind of income variability and the income volatility in institutions, is something that the kind of governance context in institutions needs to adapt to. And so I'm really glad that the CEC is doing the bit of work that they're doing at the moment, looking at their governance code, and we're working with them on that and really supportive of that piece of work, because I think it's important that how the sector is governed stays up to date with the context in which the sector is operating.
And then just before we finish on this, Andy, a couple of things from the UCAS figures. One, students more likely to be living at home. And then the other one, the sort of growth of the Russell Group, or at least selected providers, and then, you know, kind of reduction in numbers in post-92s continues. If all this stuff about collaboration, if there's a bunch of VCs in a room, in a region, and some of them expanding and some of them are therefore experiencing contraction, you ain't going to get a lot of collaboration, are you?
Well, funnily enough, I was in a room with a bunch of VCs in a region last night, and this very issue kind of came up. I think the problem here that government has, and this is at the heart of the white paper and kind of policy more broadly, is that it's clear that they, you know, want to change direction, and they want to direct more. They want to kind of see more collaboration, not just across different bits of the higher education system, but across further education. And, you know, where that all links up with R&D, going back to our earlier discussion. So, so that's the direction they want to take. And I think that by and large is a good thing. The problem is that you're trying to graft that, government is trying to graft that on the existing system. You know, the institutions, the regulations, everything essentially that we saw put in place at various points between 2010, 11 and sort of 2016, 2017. And that's incredibly difficult to do. And I think that's another reason why, you know, the white paper, which lots of commentators have said is quite a green white paper. I think that's why the legislation that will have to follow the white paper will end up having to be much more precise, because it's going to be a real, almost impossible to pull off the direction that the government want institutions to go in, while on a day-to-day basis, the senior leadership of those institutions and the governance of those institutions are still wedded to the system that was kind of, you know, set out for them to operate in, you know, nearly a decade ago. So at some point, government need to kind of sharpen those incentives and make those changes and, you know, make this more of a sure bet for those institutions, because otherwise the risk is going to be, you know, they're going to kind of resort to the familiar and continue to kind of work and think in the way that they currently do, which is kind of how, you know, how those figures then kind of play out, whether it's the UCAS admissions data, kind of, you know, some of the franchising stuff and lots of recruitment sort of internationally and so on. So, you know, I think that's the tension. It's just now up to government to kind of think, well, okay, you know, we're going to have to move harder and more firmly if we really want the whole system and those different parts of the system to kind of work in the way that we would like them to. And the white paper doesn't quite pull that off, but it doesn't mean that that's not going to happen over the next 2 to 3 years. But it's a huge quandary for institutions to kind of, you know, to like you say, make that punt and start to think, well, okay, what does this collaborative, more specialist future look like while we're sort of living and breathing and in many cases struggling in the system that we've got used to over the last decade.
Now, there's a human here, or maybe not. See if you can guess. They're telling us about an event coming up in the new year. Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its 8th year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what Graduate Ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events. Now, finally, 2025 is almost over. Thank God for that. Steph, what's been your big thing?
What's been my big thing? I think the big thing for me is it's felt like a year of two halves, right? And you'll have to forgive me because, as you introduced at the beginning, I'm the Director of Policy at Universities UK, and therefore all I think about is the policy environment for universities. But from that perspective, it's felt like a kind of year of two halves. Pre-spending review and then post-spending review and the kind of follow-up or follow-through on some of those commitments. I guess when I think back to this time last year, we were probably all still digesting Bridget Phillipson's letter, you know, with those five priorities in it after the tuition fee and maintenance loan uplift last November, and thinking through what that meant for the sector, how the sector should respond. And then we spent an awful lot of the first half of this year doing just that, thinking about what does this mean? How should we act? And our Transformation Efficiency Task Force, which I mentioned earlier, was a big part of that. And then I guess you fast forward to the SR and it was a pretty good outcome, you know, kind of great outcome in many ways, given the financial context, but there wasn't an awful lot of detail there. And then this end part of the year has felt like I was about to say a treadmill of announcements. I'm not sure that's what it's felt like. I think it's felt like pause, massive announcement, and it all kind of comes at once. But it's been an interesting year with a lot in it and pretty consequential, I think, for the higher education sector.
Michael, what, you're buried in the news every day. If you zoom out, what's your, been your moments?
You know, I think the thing that's probably stood out for me more than anything else this year is actually not being in Westminster in England, has been in Scotland with the University of Dundee. I mean, you know, all the way through 2023-24, it was sort of, the question was, you know, how would a UK government act if a provider got into serious financial trouble? And, you know, it's sort of end of last year, but all of this year has been the Scottish government having to do exactly that, you know. And I mean, for one thing, you know, sort of heart goes out to the people at the university caught up in all this. But in policy terms, it's been, you know, a steady drumbeat of big decisions and sort of very interesting responses, both in the kind of degree of parliamentary scrutiny, how the funding councils had to get much more interventionist, the sort of possibilities for legislative change. I mean, I think it's sort of really important for institutions in England and Wales to be having a careful eye on this. I mean, another thing has been about the Scottish government attitude to cuts and job losses, where, you know, they've essentially forbidden Dundee from kind of going ahead with more compulsory redundancy. And this is a really noticeable contrast to in Westminster, where Labour has, you know, basically given the green lights for cuts and, you know, reductions in staffing in a way that I think perhaps wasn't really to be expected ahead of the election. You know, so there's all kinds of reasons where I think, you know, that is, you know, for me, one of the big interesting, as well as, you know, very, very sort of distressing and depressing higher education stories of 2025.
Now, Andy, it's not as if Reform has had a brilliant month in the polls, but it's not as if the government's in a very good shape either. Where will the kind of politics of the year leave us?
Well, yeah, I mean, the government, to put it mildly, has not had an easy year politically, economically, you know, and in the way it's governed. It's taken a long time, you know, perhaps too long, for us to get from, as Steph described, you know, those five themes in a letter, which is how we saw the old year out, into the place that we now sit in. And I think the good news, they're slightly longer, well, a series of slightly longer letters and strategies. But, you know, the good news is that most of those kind of key parts of the jigsaw are now in place. You know, we've talked about the UKRI strategy in the three buckets. The industrial strategy only kind of acquires more importance kind of, you know, every month we go on. In that is some pretty ambitious regional strategy, which I think is incredibly important. We've got the post-16 white paper. You know, we've got kind of the contours of a system that we're going to live with at least for the next kind of 3 or 4 years. And I think going back to the discussion we had about the Higher Education and Research Act, we can over-egg and you know, I don't want to be one of those people who say, you know, that completely marketized the system and it was all about competition. But we can clearly see that the government is moving away from that and wants to move further away from that. And that kind of, you know, that sort of culture and set of behaviours for the system are changing quite in a sort of radical way, in my view. And I think whilst that's incredibly difficult to do, and it's incredibly difficult to do when you haven't got much money, it's incredibly difficult to do when the kind of politics and economics continues to sort of swirl around the sector. You know, government hasn't got a lot of money to kind of pump prime this, as we've discussed. But we are moving away from the system that we've lived in, and we're moving into a different place. I think it's a better place. I think the big issue with the directions we took in the Higher Education and Research Act, you know, whatever you think about competition, markets, and they're not going away, but we massively undervalued too many other things, you know, whether that was the civic agenda, whether that was kind of collaboration with FE, whether that was kind of, you know, how you really wanted to sort of increase and direct R&D funding, you know, whether that be towards economic growth, regional growth, or whatever. And so I think kind of taking those as headlines, I think the good news about this year is that we are moving away from that world and we're moving towards a kind of better conception of the way higher education, research, further education, regional policy, industrial policy all fit together. So that's the good news. You know, the bad news is that the political headwinds remain intense, and you know, the government doesn't have necessarily the bandwidth or the resource to really drive that vision home as rapidly as it needs to if it wants not just to have a kind of, you know, a better functioning sector doing the things that it wants, but the impact of that on people's day-to-day lives so that, you know, they can tackle some of the bigger political challenges that they face, which takes us back to, you know, reform in the UK, Trump in the US, and a whole host of similar situations across kind of the rest of Europe. So, you know, this is really hard stuff. And I think it's, you know, who knows how that's going to kind of pan out when we get to the end of the parliament. And it's often felt like sort of fairly slow, turgid process. And I just hope that now those building blocks are in place, we can accelerate that a bit. Not just for those in government, not just for those in the OFS, not just for those in UKRI, but for those of us in institutions who, you know, I think kind of can see that stuff on the horizon. We can see it in the communities around us. So I think, you know, we need to be as desperate to move and act as quickly as the government needs to be. So, you know, let's hope 2026 and beyond is a time for action where we really make some inroads in improving the kind of day-to-day politics and the economy that surrounds us.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHG, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Steph, Andy, Michael, Salmon, who also makes it happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next year. Thanks for all your help, support, comments and feedback in 2025. Have a great break. Until 2026, stay wonky.
Dark nights at the end of the year, cold days with an absence of cheer, so bleak. Oh, it's bleak. Work never feels like it's gonna end, and all those cards you've been meaning to send next week, it's this week. Push will see you through, even with so much to do. It's time, yeah, it's time. The money never seems enough, and this year has been extra tough. Don't mind, tonight we're fine. All around, and then you hear those sleigh bells sound. Measure our plight. Every window in the city is an ocean of light. Let's go. Let's go. Log out and turn off every device. Hats on and let's go and walk in the ice and snow. Deep snow. Oh, to put some mince pies on your plate. Tuck it, big it. Don't you know that things will be bad, whatever we do? So this year take some time for you. It's time, it's time. You know it's time.
Oh, Show.